we just didn't get there. Let's we'll get back to it before lunch.
Okay.
Thanks. Dr. Locke, and I think we're joined by Willie Vince as well, but good morning, Dr. Locke. How are we doing?
Okay, good. Good morning to everyone. Just as a quick update nationally, as we all know, things continue to climb nationally. I thought one way I'd express it is just to look at the 50 states. And currently, how we're classified, there are 15 states where COVID activity is high and climbing. These are now mostly small Midwestern states. There are 10 states where the levels are high but declining, and then there's fully 25 states where it's considered low and declining, and that is the category that Washington State is in now. So we are seeing this slow, gradual decline in Washington State and decreased outbreak activity. So the governor expressed sort of a cautious optimism about that at his press conference last week. In Jefferson County, our last case was on August 31st. So we've gone a full week without any confirmed cases. And that has dropped our two-week rate that we'll put out today. We're now at 12.3 cases per 100,000. So that's well below the 25 per 100,000 that the schools are sort of using as one of their metrics. Statewide, that metric is 88.3 cases per 100,000. So state level is still relatively high. Clallam County on the state side, at least, is listed as 73.7 per 100,000. Kitsap is 65.9. And Kitsap is still dealing with the St. Michael hospital outbreak. They're now up to 46 staff members have tested positive, 34 patients, and 3 hospital visitors have tested positive. And they're doing a very intensive kind of control strategy where they're testing staff and patients over and over again and until things are fully under control. The big news this week is the school openings that Brennan actually opened last Wednesday. So they got in 3 days. And the remaining school districts open today. I have a weekly Zoom conference with the school superintendents every Tuesday morning. So I just got off of that today. And I asked them how many of their students are involved in-person education or will be. And what they told me, in Port Townsend, about 57% of the students will be doing in person, which is 2 days a week and then 3 days online, and then the remainder will be doing full online. And most of those are high school students. In Brennan, it's higher at 90% of students will be doing some level of in-person education. And then in Quilacene, it's 80% will be in person. And I don't have the number for Chimicum yet. So we've done a lot of work with the schools. I think that the schools are very well prepared. We've been working on our kind of testing protocols and the criteria for when kids will need to be, parents will need to hold them back and get them evaluated if they get certain symptoms. Unfortunately, we'll be testing that protocol out again and again. The state guidelines just changed last week on this, so we've had to revise our protocols somewhat. But I think the changes are for the better. And currently, the way it works So if a student or staff member develops any of this long list of COVID-like illness symptoms, so certainly things like fever and cough and shortness of breath are on that list, but other things like headache and nasal congestion and diarrhea, things that are really nonspecific, those also are on the list. So anyone who develops COVID-like symptoms cannot go to school. They either have to stay home until at least 10 days have passed since the resolution of their symptoms, or they need to be tested for COVID-19. And if you're tested and test negative, then you can go back to school 24 hours after your symptoms abate. And then, of course, if you test positive, we treat you like we treat everyone else. And we would do a case investigation and contact tracing. And it gets even more complicated if you spent part of your infectious time at school. Then we would have to make decisions based on whether we need to quarantine anyone within a classroom setting. And we've sort of worked out very specific plans for all of that. We're trying to adhere as closely as possible to statewide guidelines, just to assure consistency throughout the state. But our, you know, everything is up and running, and so now's the time to put it to the test. I'm sure the students that are going to do in-person education, at least half of them in hybrid model schools, they're in classes now. And then I just learned that we have a complication with air quality from the fires. So there's some issues there and how we run the ventilation systems in the school. So we're working on that with the schools. We've got a lot of KPTZ questions this week, and I didn't actually get through the whole list last week, so I thought I better start earlier. And they touch on a number of issues I would normally report on as well. So the first question deals with vaccines and now the unfortunate consequence of controversy, I should say, that has been swirling around whether the FDA will grant an emergency use authorization and how much this is tied in with the November 3rd election and those kind of things. It's something that politicizing vaccine safety decisions is one of the worst things you can do. And unfortunately, it's been done. And I think that because of how things have played out, I don't think the usual experts, you know, so CDC, FDA, Health and Human Services, they are unlikely to be regarded as credible advisors at this point. So it's got to come down to independent science boards. And fortunately, there are several who will be evaluating the vaccines. And it's an incredibly complicated process because there's not one vaccine. There are actually over 170 vaccines that are in development internationally, and seven of them are in this phase three trials, which is the stage right before you apply for licensing. And really, in this country, we're looking at three main vaccines that are in phase three trials. They may all work, or it may just be a subset. But it's really going to come down to that making sure that there's been adequate safety testing. I know here in Washington State, we are not going to rush into implementing an untested vaccine. And even when we think we've got a safe vaccine, the initial distribution of it will be limited for a number of reasons, including just the limited supply of the vaccine. So it almost certainly will not go out for widespread public distribution because there just won't be that much vaccine. Everyone agrees that frontline healthcare workers and first responders are first in line for the vaccine. And then second in line is sort of high-risk groups. So people with chronic medical conditions, people with who are over age 65, people of color are in populations that have disproportionately high what we call morbidity and mortality, complications and mortality rates. These are, the plan is to use the vaccine where it will do the most good. But the exact details of those prioritization schemes have not been fully worked out yet. There was a question about a report in the Kitsap Sun where 30% of Kitsap cases were listed as being among Hispanic or Latino residents, which demographically only constitute 8% of Kitsap County residents. And it asked, do we have comparable figures for Jefferson County? And the answer is no. We don't have the capability of tracking that really locally, and the state's not doing it uniformly across the state, or at least on a county by county basis. But it is a significant issue. Less so probably in Jefferson and than in Clallam and Kitsap, which have higher Hispanic populations. But we do know that Hispanic populations have disproportionately been impacted by COVID-19. There's a question that asks, it says, I'm curious about the proposal to promote, quote, herd immunity as a way of getting through this pandemic sooner. It's being promoted by a doctor from Stanford who's working with the White House. Is this a possible way out of the pandemic? And this was one of the big controversies of the last 2 weeks. Indeed, there is a new coronavirus advisor in the White House who, unfortunately, his background is he's a radiologist, not an infectious disease specialist. His name's Scott Atlas. And he's the one promoting this notion of you don't need to test everyone. Maybe it would be better if you just let more people get infected and concentrated on protecting those that are most vulnerable and with the hope that eventually enough of people would become immune to the virus that would end the pandemic. And there are a huge number of problems with this approach. Not the least of which is even if you are protecting the vulnerable, the ultimate death count would be in the millions. Somewhere between 1.2 and 2.4 million people would die in the United States. Even at the, you know, we think the true mortality rate of COVID-19 is about 5 in 1,000. So it's not 3% or 5%. It's about five times as lethal as influenza. But even that, as you apply that statistic to 330 million people, you get a very high death rate. So, and even if you could get beyond that, there's really no certainty at this point that naturally acquired immunity persists. So we could potentially do that what Sweden is trying to do in a much more sophisticated way. We could potentially do that and find that the immunity only lasts for a few months. I think most infectious disease experts and public health professionals do not look at this as a viable strategy. It's just In fact, we generally don't even use the term herd immunity. We call it community immunity. People generally don't like to be compared to livestock herds and things like that. So, but we think that the best way to pursue community immunity is through a vaccine. And right now, whereas there's no guarantees, the vaccine trials are pretty promising at this point, that we will have something by the beginning of the next year. Then another question asks about testing, and mentions a new test called the Binax Now antigen test, which is described as quick, easy, accurate, and cheap. And that description is from the manufacturer. But these tests are real, and the federal government is investing heavily in them. This week, testing machines are going out to most nursing homes in the United States to do on-site testing. And there are really two types of tests. There's the most accurate, still the gold standard, is this what's called the PCR test that's done by laboratories. It's the most sensitive. It's most likely to pick up infection if a person has it. But there's a new generation of tests called antigen tests, which, while they're not as sensitive, they're not as able to pick up all tests, they're much faster and cheaper as well. And we've been predicting this for a while, and these are coming online. They're saliva-based tests. They can use nasal specimens, and they give you a result in about 15 minutes. And some of them require no additional equipment. So it's just like a card that you put a sample on, and 15 minutes later it gives you a result. So we will be using these. We'll be using them in schools and nursing homes and wherever it makes sense. But right now they're not commercially available. They're not being distributed in Washington State. But that's going to be changing, and so they have a role to play. They're not going to end the pandemic, but they're an important tool because the more testing we can do, the more effectively we can control the spread of the infection. Few more questions. Asks if is the county or state keeping statistics comparing number of infections incurred indoors versus outdoors? And the answer to that is no. We're never that certain that where the infection occurred that we could really classify it that way. Where those statistics about indoor versus outdoor risk come from are outbreak investigations. So where they've done really careful research on particular outbreaks and looked at the risk factors, that's where the data comes from that tells us that being outdoors is much safer than indoors when it comes to COVID transmission. Second to the last question, asking, I'm hearing and reading more these days about the upcoming influenza season and its intersection with the coronavirus pandemic. Is the concern largely around the stress that could be placed on the healthcare system? Will the measures we are now taking serve to suppress influenza perhaps better than the current influenza vaccine itself? That's a thoughtful question. All those things, I think, are accurate. You know, one, we are very concerned of, you know, what some people have called now the twindemic, you know, having a influenza season on top of a coronavirus pandemic, and the stresses that would cause on the healthcare system. Also, it imposes formidable challenges for us in terms of diagnosing COVID. So if we have a lot of people who have fevers and respiratory symptoms, we're going to have to test them all for COVID and influenza. So the fewer people who have that combination, or the fewer people who have respiratory illness, the less stress it's going to be on our testing capabilities. And this is why we're making a big push this year for influenza vaccination. Because it is an important tool to try to prevent infection, and especially in the young and healthy young adults are the ones where the vaccine really works the best for and has effectiveness up in the 80% range. But we need to do everything else as well. And many of us, actually myself included, are predicting that we should have a comparatively mild influenza and common cold season this year because of all the things we're doing to control COVID-19. You know, the masking, the distancing, and the limiting group sizes, and the hand hygiene. These are things typically we do not do very well in a normal flu season. And now I think we're doing it really aggressively. And so that should dramatically suppress influenza transmission and common cold virus. But we'll only know, you know, as the season progresses. And the most worrisome thing is the change in the weather and the fact that we'll all be spending more time indoors and closer quarters and with recirculated air and colder, damper climates, which tend to promote the transmission of respiratory viruses. So we're expecting to see increased COVID transmission during the winter months. It would be wonderful if we were wrong, but that's what we're planning for. And there will be at least some influenza and common cold virus transmission. And of those common cold viruses, probably half of them are coronaviruses, actually. So they're in the same family as the pandemic. It's just that they're much milder in their symptomatology. And then the final question from the KPTZ listeners is, as some of the leading vaccine candidates are now in phase three, what is the setup for distribution? I read that some vaccines will need sub-zero storage before giving it, and what is the process of determining who gets the vaccine first? So I kind of addressed that a bit. And the final prioritization schemes are being determined. I am concerned about some of the survey data, including a recent Gallup poll that where a third of the population, Americans, declared they would not get the vaccine under any circumstances. And that's not a good number to be dealing with, because that's very close to the community immunity level that we think we need to achieve to stop the pandemic, that we need at least 65% community immunity to really suppress transmission. It may need to be even higher than that. So we do need people to feel safe about the vaccine when the time comes. And some of the virus or some of the vaccines do have kind of strenuous storage and distribution requirements. One of them requires that it be stored at minus 80 degrees Celsius, which is that is liquid nitrogen cold. So it's that's unlike any vaccine that we've had to deal with so far. But you know, we could manage that. Vaccines like that you would tend to use in a mass vaccination setting. That it's not going to be a convenient thing for your local primary care doctor to have, liquid nitrogen stored vaccine. But we could do it on a large scale. So right now, we don't even know which of the vaccines will be the first one out of the gate. And what will be especially confusing is there are likely to be several first phase vaccines, and then there'll be others that completely different vaccine types that are approved later on. So people are going to have to not only choose whether they want to be vaccinated or not, but choose probably between 5 or 6 different kinds of vaccines. And most of the vaccines, it looks like, will require at least 2 doses. So that's a complicating factor as well. So we are starting to prepare for vaccine distribution now because it's such a complex undertaking. But we're not planning on having a vaccine available on November 1st, as you know, some people have, or there's been rumors in the press to that effect. Okay, so I did get through my questions finally this week.
Go ahead, Kate.
Thanks, Dr. Locke. I want to follow up on your description of kind of prioritization of vaccine distribution. I'm sure the idea has been tossed around, but curious your thinking on it. I could see that there could be a prioritization of getting the kind of young and healthy folks vaccinated who can be asymptomatic carriers and transmitters of the virus, but who are also critical for keeping the economy healthy and running and open, things like being able to let schools resume so that parents can be working. Is that ever discussed that you know, perhaps more at-risk communities are a little easier to isolate and keep isolated, unlike the young, healthy folks who generally are keeping the economy going?
Yeah, I think those are good points, and it illustrates how complex the deliberations are, because you can make a compelling argument for either case, and if you had really large volumes, you know, hundreds of millions of doses of the vaccine, you could make different kind of choices than if you have a relatively restricted number, you know, less than 10 million doses, which is sort of what they're projecting for the initial rollout. One of the most important factors, and this is as yet unknown, and that is the vaccine response rate based on age and health. So if it turns out, like influenza vaccine, for instance, that the elderly don't respond well to the vaccine, they don't get good protection for it, then that's an argument for what you're suggesting, and that is that you vaccinate the people who are the best responders to the vaccine, and you continue to protect the vulnerable populations as best you can. And we don't know that yet. Right now, in just the lab studies, the vaccines that are in phase 3 trial are actually showing pretty good vaccine or antibody response rates among the elderly. The chronically ill, you know, people whose immune systems are impaired, don't respond well to vaccines, you know, period. That's just a problem. You need a certain level of functioning of your immune system for a vaccine to work.
Thank you.
I have a question for you, Dr. Locke. We've been hearing from some of the South County schools. I know it's more in Jefferson Healthcare is bailiwick right now, but what can we do to help get some testing done in the South End to support, you know, the 2 school districts that are down there that really have identified response and quick testing as kind of critical to their school years?
Yeah, that's a priority project. And yes, we are. It is Jefferson Healthcare is doing the testing, and what they're trying to develop and implement is a system for collecting specimens at the 2 South County clinics, the Quillacin Clinic and the Port Ludlow Clinic. And the way the system will work is people will actually call up and schedule the test with the central hotline number in Port Townsend, but then they would be given a time to drive to one of those South County clinics, and someone would come out to their car and give them the a test kit, and then with the windows rolled up, you collect the specimen in the car and then give it to the person collecting it. It's very similar to what we do with the drive-through testing, except this is more like drive-up testing. So that's the plan. How quickly they can implement that and get people trained, I'm not certain. But that's what they've agreed to try to do, is to have and then we still need to collect those specimens and have them labeled by the lab and get into the courier system that goes down to University of Washington. But we think all that's doable. I suspect in the first week or two, it'll be a little rocky. And we always have the fallback position that, you know, testing's available 7 days a week in Port Townsend. But we do want to get it in South County as well.
Great. Maybe next week, can you give us a little update on how that's proceeding?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Any chance of combining flu shots with that process?
that was an idea that came up, is that the one hitch on that is, you know, if you're sick with COVID-19, if you've got a fever and respiratory symptoms, generally we don't want to give you flu shots when you're ill with a respiratory infection, just because then your immune system's dealing with two separate things. It's not unsafe to do that, but it can make you sicker. You can get higher fevers and more symptoms. So we generally hold off on flu shots. But if a person is just getting, who's asymptomatic and getting a COVID test, that, you know, they could get a flu shot at the same time. So people are looking at that, and we're definitely, Jefferson Healthcare started doing drive-through vaccinations on August 15th. So you can get flu shots that way. You can also get childhood vaccinations through drive-through visits.
That's great.
Other questions for Dr. Locke this morning? All right, we got you out relatively early. Well, thank you as always for your hard work, Dr. Locke. And passing over to Willie Vince, the Director of Emergency Management. Are you with us, Willie?
Yeah, hold on.
Yes, I am, Commissioner.
There he is.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, no, thank you. I appreciate it. Sorry about the little bit of a confusion. So I'm going to break my briefing into two parts today. The first, I was going to kind of directly address the KPTV question for us in the EOC about FEMA mask policy. So just to clarify any confusion, as far as the public distribution of masks, those have all come from the State Emergency Management Division. We've gotten three rounds of cloth masks for public distribution. The first two were adult-sized masks, specifically for low-income Washingtonians. And then we recently got a third delivery of masks, and those were the child-sized masks for low-income children. Those have all been specifically earmarked for Washingtonians at 200% or lower of the poverty line, so really focused on low income. However, we did hear last week that there might be a fourth shipment of masks from the Department of Health and Human Services, another 1.8 million across the state. We don't know if those are going to be specifically earmarked for low-income Washingtonians again, but I do know that we have more masks for low-income Jefferson County residents than we do low-income Jefferson County residents. So we're really hoping that if we do get a fourth shipment of cloth masks, that those will be for more general distribution, so we can make those available to businesses and other facilities that interact with the public but don't necessarily serve specifically low-income Washingtonians. As far as PPE and masks as a whole, I did note last week that FEMA recently announced they were extending the basically the parameters, the timeline of this disaster indefinitely. It was originally scheduled to end the end of this month, meaning that FEMA was no longer going to be providing reimbursement for eligible activities. That's now been extended indefinitely. And finally, at the very end of last week, they did come out with their official formal reimbursement policy on what exactly they were going to be reimbursing local jurisdictions for. We're still waiting from some additional interpretation from the State Emergency Management Division. FEMA did drop it at the end of the week, just before a long holiday weekend. So a lot of us are still trying to figure some specific things out. But that policy will outline, I mean, specifically what FEMA is going to be reimbursing for moving forward. So I'll have a little bit more information on that at next week's briefing. Specifically, though, up until now, we have been able to provide PPE to select partners through the State Emergency Management Division based on a priority list that the Department of Health had put forward. There were four tiers in terms of priority activities that needed PPE and needed this equipment the most, things, everything from healthcare providers to funeral homes at the lower end. So the FEMA policy will clarify a little bit, who's going to go into those tiers, who we can provide PPE to. It'll inform how much the state is going to be picking up. And really, we're going to be looking at only being able to provide FEMA-funded PPE to healthcare workers, first responders, and other individuals who directly interact with suspected or confirmed COVID patients. And then we'll have to look at funding elsewhere to provide PPE for other essential government services and things like that. So, that policy is still relatively fresh. We're still kind of wading through it. We should have more information. But just wanted to address that question and make clear there were kind of two different sources of PPE for the general public, as well as for first responders. And again, I will have a little bit better of a reading on that FEMA policy by next week. The other thing I wanted to address, and then moving away from COVID-19 for a second, was the air quality. I'm sure everyone noticed this morning some things were smelling a little bit smoky around here, as smoke from wildfires throughout the state have moved into the Seattle metro area. They've hit us here on the peninsula. That's affecting the Portland metro area, et cetera. And the reason I wanted to bring this up specifically at the COVID-19 briefing is because we talked about over the past couple of weeks, ventilation is very important to prevent the airborne spread of COVID-19. And as this air quality gets a little bit rough, one of the ways we can deal with degraded air quality is by closing our windows and staying at home and things like that. So things we've already been doing in the face of COVID-19. But if we're, in school in a congregate setting and we want those windows open for ventilation, it makes it a little bit difficult when the air quality outside is smoky and potentially hazardous. So I'm glad to hear Dr. Locke will be working with the school districts on, working with them to make sure they're striking a happy balance. For the rest of you out there, I'd recommend there is a site. It's called WASMOKE, WASMOKE. .blogspot.com that has a bunch of great resources on how you can deal with degraded air quality. It has a link to a site where you can monitor air quality in the area. Air quality, it typically, they rate it on a scale of 0 to 500. About 100 is when the air starts being potentially hazardous to, the young, the elderly, those with asthma and other respiratory conditions. And then 150 is when it starts being hazardous for the general public. And that's the point where we want to start, thinking about whether or not we should be going for that run, going for a hike, et cetera. And as of this morning, we were hovering at about that 150 point. So I recommend that everyone check out that site, continue to keep an eye on the air quality, and continue to make smart decisions about their health when it comes to both COVID-19, especially as the air quality throws a little bit of a curveball into some of those things that help with COVID-19, like keeping windows open and that kind of fun stuff. So we'll be keeping an eye on that situation, definitely. And in the meantime, we encourage everyone to, again, do the same and make a decision that's smart for them. And other than that, that's pretty much all I've got this morning, unless there are any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Willie. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, Willie, this is Philip.
You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend.
Is that changing what can be distributed, for example, to the sheriff's office and the public works, dealing with the public? And so will that shift what we need to do in terms of county PPE procurement?
Yes. Yes, it will. Again, specifically, what the FEMA policy is more or less stating is that they're really only looking to reimburse PPE for first responders. So like the sheriff's department, those folks who interact with the general public, who might be interacting with or transporting or at particularly high risk of interacting with a COVID positive or suspected. They're not looking to be reimbursing.
Excuse me, so sheriff's office would still be eligible because they're not health?
Yes.
Okay.
But other essential government services like public works and those other county departments that, you know, provide direct essential services to the general public, FEMA is no longer looking at equipping those individuals because although they, again, are essential, they provide a needed, valuable service to the general public. They're not a part of that first response or healthcare community. So we'll need to be having some discussions moving forward again on how we exactly find that funding.
Yeah, the reason I bring that up is that affects certainly county budgeting, but also other local governments as well. And as we start entering into discussion of coronavirus relief funding, then we may want.
Well, you've been listening to a broadcast of the Public Health Update on COVID-19, live from the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting with Dr. Tom Locke, Public Health Officer for Jefferson County, and Willie Bentz, Director of Emergency Management, providing information and guidance in order to minimize the effects of the outbreak of our outbreak in our county. If you have questions, submit them to your public health questions for the regular monthly commissioners meeting to Dr. Tom Locke by emailing contact us, all one word, at kptz.org. Thank you for listening.